Evening, everybody. I'm glad to see many of you back again if you didn't melt today in this extraordinary heat. Welcome back. And welcome back to our second session in this exploration of who are we, which is really, as I said yesterday, an adventure and trying to look at a couple of different things from a couple of different places. To scratch the surface, really scratch the surface about some of these issues and how we think about and relate to them in our country. I sometimes think I spend far too much time on Facebook, but today it yielded a really great quote that I wanted to share with you that seemed particularly apt after Prof. Ndebele's words last night, and it goes like this. Although they're talking about American culture, I think it's also pretty applicable to us. Our culture has accepted two huge lies. The first is that if you disagree with someone's lifestyle, you must fear or hate them. The second is that to love someone means that you agree with everything they believe or do. Both are nonsense. You don't have to compromise convictions to be compassionate. I'm going to say it again, because I think sometimes it's worthwhile. Our culture has accepted two huge lies. The first is that if you disagree with someone's lifestyle, you must fear or hate them. The second is that to love someone means that you agree with everything they believe or do. Both are nonsense. You don't have to compromise your convictions to be compassionate. And that's from Rick Warren. I think it resonates particularly with last night's call from Prof. Ndebele for each of us to step up, to speak our truths, to lean into those conversations that we often lean away from out of fear in this country. And I think it also resonates with that idea of the mob mentality that he was talking about in terms of this, you know, our country has a history of a very particularly constructed mob mentality about who people are supposed to be on the basis of race. And often those ideas and that mob mentality might be different from our own or from what we hear or see as normal. So part of the work of uncovering or taking off those masks that he was talking about last night as well is about looking beyond those things. So I think tonight, in some ways, is a very interesting way to kind of carry on from what Prof. Ndebele was saying. And we're using one of the labels that's attached to sexuality in the word queer to really look at not only the mask or the label of what that is, but Bradley, and I'll introduce him in a little bit as well, has a very particular way of looking at that, which is through how we inhabit and use and move through geographical space, and how that might affect our identities. So just a brief introduction, Dr. Bradley Rink has his PhD in Environmental and Geographical Sciences from the University of Cape Town. His area of speciality is looking at this issue of queerness and space, and rural and urban spaces. And he has and is publishing several book chapters and articles based on his PhD research. And he's a very accomplished and by reputation a very excellent educator. So I wanted to invite you not only to listen to what he is speaking about tonight, but to listen with an extra ear. Listen with an ear for how the way that he speaks about space and sexuality might be applied to any other of these labels around race, around gender, around class that we're speaking about in the sessions over the next couple of evenings. Because I don't think it's something that applies only to these issues of sexuality, although he will be exploring it from this angle. So I think that's all I have to say in introduction this evening. I hope you enjoy the session, and I'm going to hand straight over.
Thanks, Emma. And thank you, everyone, for being here. and taking the time out of your busy schedules to be part of the summer school and continuing what should be a lifelong education. I think we should never give that up, for sure. I was very pleased when I came last night to see Prof. Ndebele's opening lecture of this course. It was really just because I was interested. I wasn't asked to, but I thought, I'll see what he has to say and how it might actually dovetail with what I'm saying. Originally, when I heard him speaking of coming out from behind the mask, I thought, he took my topic, coming out, and journey of sexual identity and whatnot. Clearly, it wasn't about that, but what it was very much related. It was about coming out from behind our masks. But I was also really moved, touched, and inspired by what he said in his opening remarks. He asked us, "Where are you from?" And for me, as a geographer, I was immediately entranced. I was brought into what he was saying, because that speaks to origins, it speaks to journeys, and it speaks to a lot of adventures in between. So his ideas were very, very much geographical. They touched my heart. They made me think about my discipline and about what I'm going to talk about tonight. Yeah, as I said, they were about provenance, about quests, about desires, being who you want to be, who you are. They were about borders and margins and centers of identity and belonging. And these are all the things I'm going to talk about tonight with respect to sexual identities. And I want to begin also with an understanding, and he touched on it a bit, about how any discussion of identity is really never complete. And we are never complete. We are, in fact, as human beings, always in a state of becoming. This is actually one of the central pieces of understanding that emerged from feminist and queer geographies, that we're always in a state of becoming. We're always fluid, we're always moving, and we're always moving towards some sort of a destination. And that as humans, we are multiple eyes and multiple we's. We're these multiple layers, interlocking layers, sometimes conflicting layers of identity. So, but tonight I'm actually speaking to you as a geographer. And if there's one thing that geographers love, it's maps. I grew up loving maps. I grew up in a rural area where I used to go outside at night and look at airplanes flying overhead. And I would retreat to the quiet of my room and pull out maps and wonder where those airplanes were going and who I could be if I were on that airplane. I always had this imagination of place and space and identity, and if I'm there, I could be that. And if I'm here, I will be this. So for me, this journey is also a very personal one. And I am going to explain my rather the perhaps interesting, perhaps provocative title and the image that is on the slide here. Because it has everything to do with how I'm going to try to shape this discussion. And it has to do with, first of all, this very strange word that I had at the beginning, querying the Rainbow Nation. And by querying, I'm talking about asking questions. So to interrogate, to query. But I'm also talking about queering. So looking at something in a strange new way. Try to understand things in strange new ways. Similar to the use of the term when it comes to sexualities. It's about abrading labels, abrading difference, always trying to evade, get around particular label. It's quite fluid, it's quite messy. It's like mercury, trying to catch it. And you can try, but you're never going to quite get there. And all of that is about trying to situate who we are in this very complex democracy we live in. But specifically with regard to sexual identity, this concept of visibility, of being visible, being part of a community, and related to that, belonging. This also relates to notions of citizenship as well, which is one of your keywords. I think it goes along with democracy, I think, in the keywords. Democracy and citizenship. Look at what that has to say. It says citizenship is really complex. Citizenship is not just about the passport you hold. Citizenship is how you belong in any number of ways. The old notions of citizenship were, I'm a South African citizen, finished job. But citizenship now, we understand, is much more nuanced, much more complex, and therefore much more difficult to explain in any simple kind of way. So I'm going to take you on a queer journey, and I'm going to use maps. Everybody loves a map, particularly geographers. I even like the dusty ones that don't require an internet connection and a device to read them on. I like the ones that you actually have to look at on paper and unroll. It smells like they've been behind the cupboard for a long, long time. Those are often some of the most intriguing ones because they're static. They don't change. As soon as that map rolls off the printing press, it never changes again. Whereas new interactive maps change constantly. They can be as accurate or as inaccurate as the paper ones, by the way. as anyone who's ever driven into a stream following their GPS will tell you. But I'm going to take you through this journey using maps like this. We know this kind of map. It's kind of a comfortable map for us. It's a political map of the world. It's politically charged in its own kind of way. It's Euro and Afrocentric in a sense that it's Europe and Africa in the middle. It has a certain projection and all those things we know about maps, which make it accurate or not. But maps are actually like our identities themselves. They actually show a journey. They show a journey towards something. They show points along the way. They show the shape of that journey. They show contestation. I mean, the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans can tell us a lot about contestation and maps now. Fighting over islands in the South China Sea. But if you look on the map, if you were able to see it, it might seem like it's not problematic at all. So maps are very much, I want to try to make a comparison to our own identities. Complex, multi-layered, shifting, showing sort of the vectors of our lives, borders, mountains, deep valleys, things we always go through in our life. I'm also going to talk about maps like this. This is often called by geographers a mental map. This was done by a resident of Ubuntu, and I'll explain more about what we can learn from this, particularly when it comes to sexuality and belonging. So maps like our individuality, they're unique. This is quite a unique map. You're never going to see this map again, not in this particular form. Even the person who drew it might not be able to reproduce it again like this. And like maps, like our identities, they're sort of an edited version of the elusive truth. What is the truth? We edit all the time. But this is just another example of how we edit. But I'm also going to talk about maps like this. And Graham Shapiro and his big fish. This is based on one of the chapters that Emma was referring to, which I did a study, 12-year study over 12 years of this pink map, which some of you might have seen, which attempts, in a really interesting and problematic way, to map sexual difference in Cape Town, or sexual belonging in Cape Town. But I'll talk more about that later. It's too far off on a tangent on that, because I could talk about this one forever and ever and ever. Right. So, this journey has a number of perhaps new landmarks on it for you. And I want to make sure I explain it. It might not be new for some, but it'll certainly be new for a few. So I just want to talk about what each of these means in this particular journey talking about sexual identities. I have to talk about space, because that is my currency. That's the currency of geography, space. You work in that. I want to put more complexity to this term queer, and related to that, heteronormativity, citizenship, and then visibility, which is really all of them taken together. We're going to focus all of those on the series of maps that I'm talking about. And hopefully out of that, we're going to learn something about what it means to be a sexual other in our current times. Let's talk about space. Not this kind of space. When I say to people I work in space, my currency is space. They're thinking this. They're thinking a stellar nursery, which is actually really a true image, actually. Unbelievable. You kind of think, well, that's an artist's drawing. It's actually not. Actually, the kind of space I want to talk about is this space. And that is that social space. Our lived worlds. Okay? The spaces that you and I inhabit every single day. Whether it's the space of your own body. We geographers talk about scales, maps have scales, but space also has scales. The body is the most intimate of those scales. And then from there we go out to the domestic realm, the public realm, the state, and the world, in expanding order. So we're talking about a big chunk of territory here, space, the lived world. But just like the maps, that space is contested and negotiated. We fight over space all the time, maybe in a friendly way, but space is always contested. It's also negotiated. Where am I going to sit? Where are you going to sit? How are we going to sit so we both feel comfortable? On the most minute, micro scale. And space itself is something that we shape as humans, but it also shapes us. That's important to understand. And I'm trying to make the argument that space and identity are co-constituted. We shape each other. This is not environmental determinism, which has been since undercut a long time ago, to say because you come from here, you are that. It's not saying that. It's saying that there is this ballet between identity and space. You dance with each other and you shape each other in really important ways. And it's very, very much evident when it comes to sexualities. So again, space is the currency of geographers, and just like the temporal realm, time is the currency of historians. So we'll stick it up in our realm just to be comfortable. Next, this idea of queer. What is it? Well, in its sort of original meaning, it's really about strangeness and difference, oddity, curiosity. Can have a very negative connotation, but more recently, and in a more political context, as an identity, as a word describing identity, particularly sexual identity, it's been used as a weapon, as a shield, as a crown, to celebrate, in fact. But going back to its old term, I think it's also important to understand. But there are three different ways I want to try to really make very complex this notion of queer. First of all, as an identity. I mean, that's the one we use quite often. But also, it's a strategy. people using the term to try to challenge any sorts of normativity, typically heteronormativity, which I'll get to. But it's also a way of, just a way of seeing and knowing. This is the most typical way we often think of queer. It's a shorthand. It's a shorthand for any number of sexual others and gender others. And if you don't know what some of those are, that seems just like a confusing alphabet soup. I will help. That's what it stands for, if you've ever wondered about any of those. Particularly the Q. People wonder, what's the Q all about? Who are the Qs? Have you ever met a Q? Do you know a Q? I'll very quickly go through them. Lesbians, females who have emotional, physical attraction to other females. Gay, of course, men who have emotional, physical attraction to other men. Bisexual, those who have physical, emotional attraction to either sex. Transgender, much more complex one. And this is the one that people get caught up on quite often. Transgender is itself a bit of a catch-all, which really is about gender dissidence. People who don't subscribe to rigid gender roles based on sex. So a woman who doesn't subscribe to the fact that a woman must be and do and look a certain way, and same for other sexes as well, could also be someone who's transitioning from one gender to another. It could be someone who has what we call gender performance, someone who dresses up as another gender, a drag king, a drag queen, or transvestite as well. The questioning is someone who's really not sure where they fit in, and they're trying to figure that out. The reason this is included in this complex nomenclature is because there was, by psychologists reading, a significant number of people who were really struggling to find out where they fit. They don't know where they belong. So they recognize themselves as questioning, not sure. And then intersex is someone who's born with both sexual anatomy of both men, a male and female. Sometimes ambiguous on either end, but with both. So that's us. that's this complex segment of this rainbow nation that we live in. But of course, all that is complicated by any number of factors, but most definitely by race. And as I was saying to one of the participants earlier on, that, you know, why do we keep going back to race? Keep going back to race, talking about race. And in fact, tonight, I'm going to talk about differences in sexual belonging and visibility based on racial communities. And that is because we're not getting away from it. We're getting stuck. We're starting to sort of push out of those silos we live in. We're not there yet. So I'm going to talk about it because I have to, unfortunately. Now, queer as an identity is something that geographers have been interested in for quite some time. Because it's inherently spatial. I began by talking about the coming out question. Inherently spatial, coming out of the closet, from an enclosure to the outside world, from one scale to another. A journey of discovery, of disclosure, it's all very spatial. So geographers love this kind of thing. And the journeys to find community, to seek community, to seek others, to be part of something bigger. Queer is also a strategy. a strategy to get beyond binary thinking. So to use it as a tool in your thinking, to use it as a strategy to recognize, as Leap calls them, multiple vocabularies of same-sex identity, and to challenge the facts of heteronormativity. So, using it as a strategy. I'll use this more as a strategy as we talk as well. And then, finally, queer is a way of knowing. And we're back at this map again. You might think, why? Why? Because to some people, this is the only way of knowing the world. This is comfortable. I understand what this means. This doesn't trouble me at all. So it's sort of singular kind of thinking. Look at that. That's a very queer way of looking at the world. It happens to be an Austral-centric way of looking at the world. This is a map published in Australia and New Zealand. Because that's how they see the world. To us, we may not see the world like that here, although we do share the Southern Hemisphere with them, and we share, you know, quite a lot with them, so we could perhaps take this as our own as well. But this is such a departure from the norm, from the normative ways of understanding the world, that it's a good example of a queer map. Completely out of our realm of understanding. It doesn't fit with any kind of system of knowledge that we know. It's important to keep in mind. Next up, heteronormativity. You're like a bus conductor now. Next stop, heteronormativity. So heteronormativity is really about the expectation that a heterosexual identity is a norm, and then everything else is dissident. It's other. Could be that it's wrong. It could be that it's just so different that it's just unknowable. But it's certainly not the norm. That's heteronormativity. It's a very powerful social force. And it's a very powerful force that one can see in social space. And one can see how it acts on particularly sexual others. And this is very much related to a term which I'll use also throughout, which is homophobia, the irrational fear of people who are homosexuals. So they kind of go hand in hand. And the best part of this definition I like is Alison Murray's term, the ambient heterosexual. So as if we live in this sea of heterosexuality, and there are these little islands around that some people get washed up on, or some people escape and swim as fast as they can to, and they cling like to a life preserver, to these little islands, these little beacons of otherness. So I think her term is really beautifully spatial, but also says sort of, in a way, how social space works for many people in the world. That we paddle around in a sea of the heterosexual. Okay, so how does that look? All right, well, how that looks on this image that we've seen before is that sort of all of this is the ambient heterosexual. And there could be little pockets of otherness around, but it's not the norm, for sure. Next, visibility. Very important in terms of belonging. So this concept of queer visibility, particularly, this is one that Andy Tucker uses quite usefully, is really about how queer groups and individuals overcome heteronormativity. And they become visible. They enact their identity themselves in space. They push themselves out there to be part of something, to belong. essentially. That's what visibility is. Visibility also is about challenging, particularly the assumption of heteronormativity and the imposition of heteronormative control, for sure. That's visibility. And if I think there was at least one architect in the room, a couple of architects in the room, if you know Bentham's Panopticon, you know that this is really visibility and control explained. Foucault loves Bentham and loves this idea of the Panopticon because the Panopticon was built so that you could keep an eye on prisoners. This is also used for hospitals as well. By just having someone in the center that you couldn't actually see. So you never quite knew if you were being watched or not. So in actual fact, everyone could be controlled just by the mere thought that maybe someone's watching. Very effective as a prison device. Okay. But this is also related to this notion of visibility where hatred actually comes out of visibility for many people, particularly sexual dissidents. And in Farr's reading of it, particularly for visible gay men, who absolutely, they counter everything against the patriarch and that which is heteronormative. It's wrong. It's wrong in so many ways. And if you're visible about it, then you should be punished. Right? So visibility is really, it's complex, it's potentially dangerous, but it's something that people seek. And that's related to citizenship or belonging. So, as I mentioned before, I'm going to have to start going a little faster, I see, on my time, just on my slides that I have yet to talk about. Old notions of citizenship are about the nation state. Whereas now, we can talk about citizenship with having other qualities, cultural and otherwise, that go beyond state control, where they're complex, they're multi-layered, multi-natured, very, very complex. When we talk about citizenship, what protects us as citizens is the Constitution. And we're very lucky that way. Not just lucky. We're very honored. It's very important. And we have what many think to be one of the most forward-thinking constitutions in the world. But there's a huge disconnect. Disconnect. A disconnect between de jure rights. So what the law says is your right for protection, for participation, for belonging, and de facto lived experience. In fact, what happens when one moves around in space? Because for many, life looks like this. This is going back to that first image I had up. This I took in 2008 at Cape Town Pride event. Hooray. For many, this is what life in the ambient heterosexual is like. First of all, it's trying attempts to be visible that are often difficult to do, that are countered by homophobia that silences you, and at the same time, they try to recognize that they are more than just one thing. They're multiple. They're complex. I can't say it, but I'm your queer Muslim mother. That's violating about every kind of rule and any kind of normativity in the book. Okay? But I think it's a very good example of how sexual others abrade against so many normative rules and controls and fight against being able to be themselves, to be visible, to be participatory, to be part of public space. So now, let's go back to the maps. In the next few slides, I just want to talk about how queer visibility can be read through a number of different types of maps. Here's a map. This is from Bill Leeb's work, 2005, when he interviewed a whole range of members of, I'll broadly say, the queer community in Cape Town. And this person happened to be a white man who was in his mid-20s, lived in the CBD, or the Atlantic Seaboard, excuse me. And his map of queer Cape Town, once analyzed, looks very CBD-centric. So it's like, it's town, basically. It's town, and it's a number of, UCT appears here as well. But what's very prominent are the social sites, clubs and bars. Let's just keep that in our head. It's one way of understanding one queer person's understanding of Cape Town. And interestingly, what emerges from Leeb's reading of it, Andy Tucker's reading of it, in his study, and my study, is we all triangulate and actually find out the same thing, which is, I suppose, what we should do in science. But what we find is that amongst a race-based community of white queer people, the sort of general trend is that their visibility is really in social sites. It's in clubs, in the public sphere. And this is sort of a lager mentality of, all right, circle the wagons, let's build a club, and let's all go there, and we can be who we are, and when we go outside, we're not, we're someone else. Let's just be who we are in this club. So it tends to be very CBD-centric. Exclusive zones of identity, the Rotherhand, was shaped at this place that people were calling the gay village. Like, there was this little village in the town where all the gays went. Not true, but it was shaped that way. Zones of exclusivity, macho man culture, which looks something like this, but very limited notions of belonging. So if you wanted to belong in this particular queer site, queer space, you better have money, you better be white, and you better have a great body. Because that's what all the signs are pointing to, what you should be. And then comes in the pink map, which has been around since 1999. It's a tourist publication. But what it interestingly does, and what I've tried to demonstrate what it does, is it really serves as a barometer of changes happening in the landscape, in the social space. How notions of sexual citizenship are now starting to change in Cape Town. So I will try to get to all of those in the time I have remaining. But it's a very interesting publication, because it's meant for tourists, meant for locals. But how do you map this otherness? How do you map sort of the places where one can go and be and belong if they're not limited to a certain subsection of this group? And what Leeb found, and what I've also found, is that it's really the embodiment of the city of whiteness. And this is my favorite of all the covers from 2001, where the map of the Vatican is actually superimposed on this white model of the body. Like, the body is the place, and it all sort of becomes one. And we'll see how different this is from other expressions of visibility in the next few slides. Starting with this one, which is from a 30-something woman, lesbian woman, who, in her map of queer Cape Town, doesn't look like Cape Town at all. But unless you sort of take the mountain, which is a bit of an impressionist view of the mountain, Table Mountain. But I have it superimposed with this 2000 version of the pink map. because this was the first time that any kind of a female figure appeared on a pink map. And she wasn't actually a female. She was actually a man, dressed as a female. So again, the problem of representation in lesbian communities. They aren't there. They disappear. And here, what happens, what we see in Ulrich's map, is her queer Cape Town is in the social spaces of her friends' homes. And it speaks to a whole different sensibility of belonging. And it speaks to sort of the capricious nature of lesbian social spaces, that they don't locate themselves in the CBD and in clubs and bars, but they actually are much more fluid. And they're spread around in friends' homes, so much more difficult to get your hands on, understand. And then we look at, it gets more interesting. Because now we look at Leslie's map, Leslie who comes from Athlone, and we start to see how queer Cape Town starts to spread out. Yes, CBD, but it also spreads out into homes, bars, shops, other places around the Cape Peninsula. And what we find, and what Leif and Tucker have also found, is that queer visibilities in the colored community, so-called color community, are very different. They're much more fluid. Include things like house parties, gender performance, fluidity of even of sexuality as well. And no evidence of clubs where it says gay people only or lesbian people only. Much more fluid and open as well. It gets even more interesting. Gender performance becomes a strategy which one sees more and more in colored and black communities, queer communities, as a means of being visible, wearing your queerness literally on your shoulder. Whereas in the white communities, it's about going in someplace, being who you are, and leaving again completely different. Like hiding who you are in certain spaces. Here's, look at me, I am different. I'm a gender outlaw. And it's much more visible in these communities. Same with Simon's map. Simon's map, Simon was also from Mugulecce, goes all the way from Khayelitsha, actually, all the way into town, including Woodstock, where nothing much is happening. Anybody from Woodstock? Sorry. but interestingly, can include Shabins. Boy, I mean, you want to think of like a heteronormative space, Shabins must really be macho. But it's not the case, we see. We see that there's much more fluidity. Now, again, he's a man. I'll talk about the difficulties which would be imposed for women just now. There's a similar map. This was a group of people who comprise this map, also from Gugulethu, where black visibilities, queer visibilities, are very complicated in this image, in this map, because it speaks to the connection, yet the separation between town and township. We shouldn't allow ourselves to think that town and township are completely divorced from each other, because they actually rely on each other. But there's significant mediation that happens, and the significant challenges that are happening here in the sexualities that are depicted in this map. Particularly in that they're spread out, they're in shared space, they're very heavily mediated by fear and violence, particularly for black lesbian women, where there's intense homophobia, and what is unfortunately called corrective rape, which we all know about, we've heard about in the press. But also what affects now, sort of moving forward from 2005 to my study 2013 and now, there are such sudden shifts that are happening. So 94 happens, 96 we have this brilliant constitution, all of a sudden everyone's free to be who they want to be, right? No, there's a lag, there's this cultural lag that hasn't quite caught up in a lot of communities. And so the sudden shifts that we've seen in de jure rights haven't yet been matched by de facto experience. And this is one of the key pressures, particularly on black queer communities, but also affecting all of the communities that we're talking about. So, in the final few slides, I just want to spend a bit of time to talk about sort of now becoming. Where are we going? How are we moving forward? From sexual citizenship, so belonging in a sexual sense, because of your sexual identity. One of the most interesting findings from my study was that in the early days, particularly in the pink map, it was all about just being sexual, being gay, being lesbian, and about all the bodies that were involved in that, beautiful people, dancing, having a lovely time. Phil Todros actually hit it right on the nail here when he said that it's an archive, this pink map. It really sort of shows where we're going, where we're becoming, how we're becoming. So as I said, it started off in the early days really about the body and about sexual citizenship. I'll read a very, very brief segment from my piece, how this actually changes. So we go from this body here to something completely different, from something which I'm calling consumer citizenship, how people are in these even race-defined groups of sexual dissidents, starting to divorce themselves from their notions of sexual citizenship to consumer citizenship, belonging because of what they buy, not because of who they are. As I say, consuming the body to consuming for the body, eating more, transgressing less. You see these shifts in the maps. And the piece I wanted to read, actually, it's really about, I compared some of the entries in this piece. This is from 2008, where the line between restaurants and what used to be a male-only massage parlor starts to get blurred. And it goes like this. It's not only size, but the combination of taste and flavor sensations that makes Colpaccio Pizzeria stand out in the crowd. Hunky pizzas, satisfying pastas, and sexy salads, plus great locations and friendly service, add up to fun and relaxed, good food experience. So, these sexual innuendos sort of demonstrate how the map situates desire and how it's changed. As another example, hot, friendly, diverse, pleasure, and license for wine and malt described this male massage parlor I was talking about before in the 1999 edition, while hunky, size, satisfying, and sexy described Colcaccio Pizzeria in the 2008 edition. One might be forgiven, you know, for mistaking the two, this sort of culinary desire for corporeal desire. But what starts happening, what we start seeing, is a shift toward being a consumer citizen rather than a sexual citizen. And it's all over the map. And that's part of one of the big findings I've seen, that queerness becomes something different now. Being different shifts because particularly young people coming of age and not having to sort of be caught up with the ways things were done in the past. The worry about being caught out for being who they are. Born free is not knowing what it's like to be thrown in jail for being with a same-sex partner on the street, showing their affection. So the map serves as quite an interesting barometer, I think, of how things change and how they are changing. And my final slide is really just to ask the question then, who are we then? You know, how do we continue to seek visibility? In which ways we do that? Yes, there's growing tolerance and acceptance, but to what end? Where are we pushing that? How are we accepting of other people? There are still very troubling contestations to this as well, like I mentioned. Continuing difficulties, particularly of Black lesbians, to be who they are in a number of different social and public spaces. This trend toward new ways of belonging, of citizenship, I think is something which is going to affect sexual citizenship as well. And simply all of our struggle to belong, because that's really what everyone tries to do. So the struggle does continue, and it will continue, not only for sexual others, but I think for all of those others that we talk about this week. And that is where I end. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Brandy, thank you very much. That was very interesting.
A journey. Everyone that has a very interesting map, I think it jumped around. We have 10 minutes for questions, so can I take a first round of maybe three, or would you rather have them one at a time?
I can do one at a time, it's fine.
Okay.
Mm.
Yes. She's heard a lot about, and I'm paraphrasing, the term heteronormativity has become something that they're incorporating in medical school, in a medical training a lot. And she's wondering whether the use of heteronormativity is a way of making heterosexual people on that side and queer people on this side and reinforcing a boundary. Did I catch you accurately?
Yeah, I think, actually, I agree. I think you're continually using that border to describe itself, and therefore it's remaining intact. But the key is bringing more people together so we understand both sides of the divide, as it were. That heteronormativity does exist, and it still exists. That we can actually challenge that and change that, but it takes knowledge on both sides. So I think it's more about getting medical professionals together so they understand what that is, and then trying to break it down themselves. So I think you're on the right path, but unfortunately I think we do have to use the terminology to describe what is still happening in very material ways in many people's lives.
And maybe if I could phrase it another way, and just a way of thinking about a lot of these labels, if somebody had not called you heteronormative, would you even know that that's what you were? All right? Because and I speak for myself as a heterosexual person, I can live in a world where nobody questions, comments, where myself and the way that I act in the world is completely normal, so I completely take it for granted. And unless somebody pointed out to me that actually, no, you're not everything, your assumptions are based on a whole set of, ideas about how the world works, and your ideas carry power, therefore they dominate the space, doesn't mean that this is all that there is. How would you even know that that actually happens? So sometimes I think the labeling could be useful when it's pointed up towards the people who occupy positions of power. Right? Yeah, sorry, I had to say that. Yes.
Could I ask more about the maps, please? What were people asked to do when they did their maps in terms of their own space?
Yeah.
And also, one or two of the maps, it wasn't, there were interesting things there that I don't know what they meant.
Can I just, so that everybody can hear, she's asking about the personal maps that people drew and what exactly they were asked to do when they did those maps and some of the interesting things that have came out of that.
There's a lot more interesting that's come out of these maps, let me tell you that. But the question was very simply put, draw a map of queer Cape Town. Okay. In actual fact, Leap used the term gay Cape Town, to be precise. That's very typical of a mental mapping exercise, is giving a very simple prompt that's not too much of a leading prompt, so that it will elicit what is actually in the person's mind, what it actually means to them. So, yeah, so we could actually spend, I could have just used one map, actually, to try to make a point, because it is very complex. Aside from the knock against Woodstock, what's important in this map is that there is a connection. Again, this was a Xhosa man from Gletu. There is a connection to sort of those whites-only clubs that we've been talking about. And so we complicate it. It's much more complicated than we can see just at its face. But the way that he talked about his interaction with those spaces was quite useful and also supported his Leap's conclusions that they were sort of exclusionary spaces. So simple prompt, and used in much more complex ways. He only had, in this whole piece, he only analyzed 5 maps and he expanded on it at length.
I also want to start drawing some connections, so if I can say one thing before I take the 2 hands here. One of the other things when we talk about shifting identities in post-apartheid South Africa is to deal with our legacy of spatial and racial segregation. The mob mentality didn't just exist in people's minds, it existed in physical reality about where white people, colored people, and black people were allowed to live and move. And I think that the movement, and I think this is a great map to show it, of black people into white spaces is very common for a lot of different reasons, for work, for leisure, all those sorts of things. But the movement in the opposite direction doesn't really happen. And that's part of the shifting that we would have to do if we want to create this kind of society, well, that I like to imagine is possible. There was a hand up here, I think Karen, yes.
I'm asking about thinking about it.
Yes. Yes, yeah.
My other question is, do you see a point in the future where that map sort of becomes a similar thing to the restaurant map, the bar map, or do you think it will always stay as a separate map, especially something like that?
Can I repeat just for hearing's sake? So she's asking about the pink map and where she can read about the actual work that he's done in putting this whole chain together, but also whether that pink map could be assimilated into a tourist map of bars, restaurants, places.
I do have what's on my academia site, but I'm not sure everyone will be able to access that. So I can also give it for people can access it. If you don't have sort of access to sort of UCT libraries, I'd be happy to give it, and I wouldn't use that email list again, but I'm happy to provide it, but if anyone can access it, if you Google me, you'll find an academia site, which UCT is part of, and I share it on there, because I own the rights to that. So that's free for sharing, and it is very much related to the restaurant map, to the craft map, to the rainy day map, and all those maps. They're all done by the same map makers, ANC Maps. And it's very interesting, the whole story that comes out of why it came about and why Philip created the map. Maybe one day it will be, and maybe that's a good sign, if it becomes integrated with another map, because it says that all space is pink space. So that would probably be a good thing.
Monica.
I was really excited at the idea of a conversation expanding. I don't know if that's happened between. So this is the pink map is very Western Cape or Cape Town centric, and and I was curious about where else that kind of exercise had played out in this mapping particularly, because it connects to what Emma was saying also about the reversal of space. So for example, in the Joburg Urban City Center, space for movement as a homosexual person is very much an urban space, and the kraals are actually the retreated malls and possibly private spaces and private clubs away from that urban hub. And that is a historical, geographical legacy. And it's also about accessibility, because obviously Hillbrow is a great hub as well. And it's literally the opposite of this demographic story.
I think it'd be very interesting to see how that, you can compare that. We can't compare with what we've done with Joburg, because it isn't anything that's the same, because Joburg is embedded on a set, like you said. So very difficult to make comparison, but I think it'd be brilliant to do. In fact, I'm already starting to work on another version of another pink map, which we're trying to bring in people, even street people, and sort of people that don't get caught up in the normal queer communities in Cape Town, to try to understand that their particular queer journey is places and spaces.
Yes, last question.
Just in terms of world geography, my understanding is there's certain, they call it hotspots, which seem to attract them in. The ones that come to mind are San Francisco, Mykonos, Cape Town, and I'm sure there's a list of them. And I just wanted your view on what it is that makes these things what they are. Why would they be attracted to those particular spots, and what's going on?
So just for hearing sake, there's a
global hotspot,
or global hotspots, that's not working.
Global hotspots and global cities that seem to attract gay men, and what does Bradley think it is about those spaces that attracts?
I talk about that, actually a lot of this work is based on my PhD thesis, and in the thesis I expand much more about sort of the globalization of gay culture, and Cape Town's part in that. And it's actually it's a big falsehood, because this notion of a global gay identity is such a small subset of an even small community that it actually silences queer communities that don't have money and don't have the ability to travel extensively and live in these world cities. But those kind of spaces cater to these global elites, global queer elites. And the city of Cape Town and Cape Town Tourism embraced that fully in 1999, 2000, where they actively pursued what they called the pink dollar, the pink euro, the pink pound, to great effect. Made a lot of money. And this gay village idea grew as a result of that. So there are these hotspots, yes, that sort of accumulate, but they accumulate a very elite group of people. Interesting to study them, but it's a very small group out of a very large pool of others.
The lifestyle that they lead is common to those hotspots.
Yeah, very much, very common, highly mobile, so they would be considered, we call geography the kinetic elite. They're always moving. You know, they use seasons as verbs. They summer here, they winter there. it's quite an interesting subset of people. But yeah, and Cape Town was part of that.
So what did Cape Town do in 1999, the Arts and Culture Department, to cater to their particular needs?
They had the City of Cape Town and Cape Town Tourism had a strategy for attracting the queer community. And they did that through advertising, they did it through very specific promotions, they did it with tour operators, MCQP, the Mother City Queer Projects, was a big draw. I mean, they brought jumbo jets full of queer folk into Cape Town. And I'm quite literally jumbo jets that they charted, so it worked.
All right. So we come to 6:30. Thank you very much for your time, for your insight, for sharing your expertise, Bradley. That was really a fascinating journey, and I hope provided another set of lenses, another way of looking at who we are, and we'll continue on this adventure tomorrow evening. Thank you.
hours, so